Europe was undergoing what is sometimes called the 12th century Renaissance, and it is marked by the fact that towns are actually beginning to reappear as of some importance in parts of Europe. Now, certainly, there had been remnants from old Roman cities that were still around with a very limited population. In other words, the town had not totally and absolutely disappeared. But now you have a marked growth of towns in the 12th century. And the first important towns appear in two areas. One is in Italy, where in fact towns had never thoroughly disappeared. And the other area is up in the lowlands, that is, the area that we would call Belgium today, roughly, in the northern France, called Flanders at that time. And they start in those places, most particularly because manufacturing begins in these areas, and particularly cloth manufacturing. So that the woolen cloth trade becomes extremely important beginning in the 12th century. And I might add that what happens basically is that a series of persons begin making their money in cloth, and they have a tendency to move from cloth making into banking, and your earliest bankers as a result tend to be in Italian cities and in some of the Flemish cities, so that you have that general movement. Now, when towns appear, the thing that marks a town, really, is that it is granted a certain amount of self-government. A town is usually given a charter of liberties by the local lord, the man who owns the territory around. And the charter of liberties usually includes all or some of these factors. For one thing, people are allowed to own ground or land inside the town freely. They pay a small money rent for this to the lord yearly. But when we say that it's owned freely, it means that they can will it as they choose, can sell it or buy any of these factors. In addition to this, very important to towns is the right to hold a market and sometimes a fair. A market is held weekly, at least. A fair may be held at longer intervals, usually in connection with the local saint's day, and will attract traders from a much wider area than the local market does. But it means that the town can charge tolls and fees for persons who bring goods here. In other words, there's a basis for raising money within the town itself. In addition, towns usually had charge of local justice. This was important to towns because they did not want to be under the type of legal structure that applied to either nobility or to peasants. They wanted a kind of law that dealt with property, sale of property, markets, all of this kind of factor. So the law of towns, administered by the town itself, is important. Very often the top law officer might be appointed by the local lord, but the legal structure would grow up independent of him. And they might or might not have the right to coin money themselves as well. All of these are important so-called liberties. These are the charters of liberties that go with the new towns. Indeed, about this time, and particularly by the early 13th century, feudal lords had begun to discover that towns were a source of cash money. And this was their major source of cash money, because in the long run, otherwise, they simply ate up surplus things produced or traded them off for other goods. Cash is hard to come by, but a source of cash is a town. And the result is that a good many feudal lords began to found new cities in places. They would set aside a territory, give a charter of liberties, invite traders into it, and this begins to occur all over Europe. You can usually tell them because they are called things like Villa Nova, new city, Villeneuve in France, new city, Villa Franca, free city, Villefranche, all of these. Anytime you see the name of a town that has one of these, it's a new town founded by a feudal overlord to get cash money out of it. This is precisely the way that works. Now, within the town, as they are found, essentially the government usually fell into the hands of the guild system. Now, medieval guilds are, of course, foundations made up of persons engaged in the same kind of business. So that you have wool makers guilds, fullers guilds, they treat wool, you have carpenters guilds, stonemasons guilds, goldsmiths guilds, candle makers guilds, bakers guilds, butchers guilds, every single type of industry or work has a guild structure. Now the guild structure is not like a union. Let me make this quite clear. A guild structure is built up to do several things. One is that it forms an organization for mutual support, which means basically that a guild will take care of widows and orphans when a guild member dies, and they will have social occasions when they get together and drink wine and get sloshed every so often, have a good dinner party. But more important than this, they take charge of this particular type of work in which they set up their own regulations to establish the quality that is going to be produced and also which persons will be allowed to be masters and have apprentices and so on. The usual thing is that guilds, particularly in the north, tended to have their own secrets, which are very carefully cherished and kept. That is, various ways of making different kinds of cloth, for instance. So that, particularly in things like these, you have guilds in one city knowing how to make a very fine cloth, and the name of the cloth often comes from the city that produced it. Cambric comes from Cambrai, for instance. A type of tapestry came from the town of Arras, and we call it Arras. And so on and on with this. So that almost all names of cloths are connected, in fact, with the source of origin. And only the persons, the masters of that city, knew how to make this particular kind of weave. So there are such things as guild secrets as well. And the normal process in a guild was that a master is allowed to take on apprentices, that is, a number of persons to whom he would teach the trade. Now, an apprentice usually entered into his apprenticeship somewhere between the ages of 10 or 12 at the latest. And he is normally apprenticed for 7 years. In the course of those 7 years, he learns this, and then he graduates and becomes a journeyman. Now, a journeyman is a worker in this trade who is paid money for doing work, but he is not a master. And you do not become a master until you have produced a masterpiece, and that's where our term comes from. When you have finally learn to bake that perfect loaf of bread, you have become a master baker. And only when the guild recognizes it this way can you then take on apprentices and set up your own shop. So this is the way it operates. And as long as you have, of course, a period of expanding population and growth of cities, there's plenty of room for expansion in all of these businesses. So it's an expanding business consistently here. Now, because the guilds were organized, and were organized official units, it is very easy for them to take over the process of government. And this is why, in fact, government tends to fall into the hands of the guilds. In other words, the persons who rule, whether they be burgesses or whatever your group is called at the head of the local government, is usually selected from guild members. Now, it is true that you get an enormous variation on this, because in most towns and cities, you develop into what are called the major guilds and the minor guilds. The major guilds are those that are rich, and the minor guilds are those that don't make as much money. And as you might expect, in some cities, government falls into the hands of the major guilds, and periodically you get rebellions on the part of the minor guilds against this kind of restriction, and so on. So it isn't always peace and quiet in the cities. In addition to this, cities had something which is known as the free air of towns. And this meant that if a serf moved into a town and managed to live there for a year and a day without being taken back to the manor, he is a free man. Now, this is one way that you cease being a serf and become a free man, is through the free air of the cities. And, of course, for the population growth, this was not all that difficult to do. If you just had the nerve to leave the family farm, so to speak, and move to the city, you usually were allowed to stay there. So the cities are growing. They're growing in size, and they're growing in wealth very sharply through the 12th and 13th centuries. And along with this growth of towns came also, of course, a new burst of intellectual interest. This is, again, sometimes called the 12th century Renaissance. Now, part of that certainly stems out of the new kind of information that came in from the Arabs. In other words, the rediscovery of classical literature through the Arabs, now translated from Arabic into Latin. And this included such things as Aristotle, Roman law, Greek writers on medicine, all kinds of factors like this suddenly enter the Western world. And one of the results of all of this is the beginning of universities. Now, universities grow up slowly, and I might say in a somewhat haphazard fashion. The early schools were, of course, in monasteries, and then as the towns grew up, usually connected with cathedrals. But they were all church-run schools. And you went to school, if you were in training, to become a cleric, generally, and possibly also hoping to be used in government. You could take minor orders, for instance, become a cleric, but would still have the capability of getting married. Only if you entered the priesthood could you not marry, for instance, and raise a family. So the schools grew out of this slowly, and universities grew up. Now, universities in the Middle Ages tended to come in several varieties. The most important kind of university, the one that had the greatest prestige, was a theological school. And the most important of all theological schools is Paris. Paris is one of the key universities of the entire Middle Ages. It is the place which is considered to be the final authority on theological matters. Next to Paris, the most important university in the Middle Ages is down in Italy at Bologna, and this was a famous school of law, most particularly of Roman law and eventually of church or canon law, which is founded also in this period. But certainly it is the European center for the study of Roman law and will retain that position. There is a third kind of university that appears. This is a university that specializes in medicine. And the first of these was down in Italy at Salerno. The most important was at Padua. So the Padua becomes the key center for the study of medicine for the next several centuries. Now, universities were informal organizations, to say the least. Universities, for a long time, since they did not have buildings or libraries or anything permanent, what they had were a series of teachers and students who came to learn from them. Normally, for instance, at Paris, you would have a man admitted by the faculty of teachers to teach at the university. He would then have to hire a hall. And he would then give his lectures in the hall that he hired, and students would pay him directly. Now, students lived wherever they could get rooms in any way possible. So they would sometimes band together. And in Paris, the university is run by the faculty. It's the faculty who set up the laws and regulations for the university. It's the faculty, indeed, that will bargain with townspeople if the town starts going in for rent gouging, things like this, all of this type of regulation. Now, the students who go to the universities, including Paris, are very much a mixed bag. They may go there as early as the age of 12 years old. And they may go there as late as the age of in their 40s. And they come at all ages in between. And no one is really responsible for them. They live on their own, and they make their own way. Indeed, students tend, from our earliest records of them, to get by in large part by begging. They beg on street corners, and they sing songs to beg and things like this. And they write the usual letters home. We have quite a number of them surviving and doing fine. Please send money. Very simple. Students tend to remain much the same over many, many generations. Send money is the great cry. We know a good deal about student pleasures. They tended to write their own songs. And as far as we can tell from these, students never seem to mention studying at all, even in the 12th and 13th century. On the other hand, they do talk about student pleasures. And the great student pleasures of the Middle Ages are, one, gambling. They're inveterate gamblers. Two, drinking. They are terrible drunks. And three, horrible. Gambling, drinking, and sex seem to occupy the real critical center. Rather extraordinary. There are marvelous poems in which they tell you which universities have the best wines and where, and which have the cheapest whores, and which the best. You know a lot about how students live in these areas. Rather splendid. And these are theological students. this runs along that way. Now, there are certainly some students who are more serious than this. Bologna is a good example, on the other side of the coin. I suppose law students are always more serious. They seem to be even at UCLA. But Bologna is an example of a university which is, in fact, run by the students, not by the faculty. And it's the students at Bologna who establish the rules and regulations for the way things shall be run. And I must say, they do set up stringent regulations. It is notable that faculty are not allowed to be late for lectures. Faculty have to lecture the full hour also. Faculty are not allowed to leave town. And in fact, even if a faculty member gets married, the students allow him one day for the honeymoon and a back-to-work day. It's a very stringent setup that they have here. So law students, at least, are serious. I really don't know much about medical students, but I expect they were serious, too. So I must say, medical learning left something to be desired in this period. It's basically work on old Greek texts, particularly Galen, who worked in the 2nd century A.D. Galen is more important than Hippocrates in this particular century. Galen comes in through the Arabs and with Arabic tongues. The thing that's nice about Galen, as far as the Middle Ages is concerned, was that it's kind of easy. You can memorize it in short order. So that, for instance, this earth is made up of four basic substances: earth, air, fire, and water. On the other hand, a human being is made up of, or human beings are made up of, four basic temperaments. Now, the temperaments depend on which one of four basic fluids in the body you have in excess. If, for instance, blood is the thing which rules you, you are going to be of sanguine temperament. You will be cheerful and jolly and so on. On the other hand, if phlegm, which is another one of them, is the more abundant substance in your body, you will be phlegmatic, which means that you really don't get very excited about anything. You sort of make through life somewhat sulkily, perhaps. On the other hand, if you have excess of yellow bile, which is the third possibility, your temperament is color, which means that you have a very short fuse. You tend to blow off, get angry, outraged, all the time. That's the third temperament. Now, the fourth one is when you have a surplus of black bile, and this is the melancholy temperament. Now, melancholy means not only what we think of when we use the term, but this is also the sign of great learning and of genius. Geniuses are always melancholy. It goes with advances in sciences and arts and so on, where geniuses of necessity are broody, as you probably know. They are not happily sanguine. They are not phlegmatic. They don't get angry all the time. They brood over things. So you have four basic temperaments. You have four basic qualities. Nice things come in a lot of forms. Everything is a combination of being either hot or cold, wet or dry. And these run through. Now, as you can see, it's not going to be really easy to build a course in medicine on ideas like these. It doesn't give you terribly firm guidance as to precisely what to do about anything. But nonetheless, Galen is the basic source for medical studies and medical works. There are lots more complications beyond this. But it is notable that medicine will, for instance, not really get into a close study of anatomy for several centuries, and the knowledge of anatomy will indeed be somewhat limited. Cures will also be limited. Basically, for a very long time in medicine, there's a kind of basic theory that if anybody doesn't feel well, you draw a pint of blood. If they go on not feeling well too long, you draw some more blood. Eventually, they feel dreadful. If you keep it up long enough, of course, they die. That takes care of that. But medical information does, shall we say, leave something to be desired in this period. However, there are schools of medicine, law, and of theology. And these are the basic things that are studied. Now, in the schools of theology, you studied various things. This is where you studied classical literature. You studied grammar and you studied rhetoric, for instance, by studying Latin authors, by studying Cicero and Virgil and Quintilian, and a whole series of classical authors are studied here. But eventually, of course, you move on into studying dialectics. And this gets you into the process of basing things on reason. Indeed, the Middle Ages, to a major degree, has to try to learn how to think logically. And indeed, there's no use in your assuming that, of course, everyone thinks logically always, because, in fact, almost no one ever thinks logically, including you. This is one of the things that has to be learned. And the Middle Ages goes at this, and this goes along with the rediscovery of Aristotle. And Aristotle writes basic works on this, and when he is rediscovered, this creates an enormous sensation throughout the university structure of Europe.
Aristotle is a whole set of new ideas. He writes about logic, and he also writes about the things of this earth. Biology and geology and geography and politics and all of this kind of thing. Now, nobody studied this ever in the Middle Ages. So it's a whole vast new world. And students were really passionately determined to study this. Now, the church was a little chary about this in the beginning. They weren't really sure that Aristotle was good for them. In the first place, he certainly wasn't a Christian. And this certainly wasn't revealed truth, and this praise for Aristotle seemed highly dubious to the church. They weren't sure what to do about it at all. And indeed, the whole introduction of logic brought some real problems. There's the famous case of Abelard. Abelard is a Frenchman. He's born down near Nantes, and as a very young man, he goes up to the University of Paris. The University of Paris has a very famous scholar, theologian, as the head of it. And Abelard is still a very, very young man. And he engages this famous scholar in a very famous debate. And he drives the famous scholar into the ground and makes him change his mind about things. Now, this made Abelard's reputation, and incidentally outraged the university at the same time. No professor likes to be made a fool of publicly. I want you to know this now, in case you ever get a chance. That makes him somewhat unpopular, but students, of course, flocked to him. He set up his lecture system. All kinds of students flooded to him. He began working things out, and he eventually, in fact, wrote a book called Yes and No. See and No. And the book posed a whole series of interesting problems because he went through both the Bible and early church authorities, famous authorities, and he pointed out that every so often one of these contradicts another. And if there are contradictions, which is right, yes or no, and he simply sets up a series of these problems to be argued and discussed logically. How, if the Bible is revealed truth, can you somehow logically find what is the proper answer out of this, yes or no? And he simply sets up a whole series of these problems in yes and no to be argued and discussed. Like such, there are all kinds of things. Was Adam saved? Did Adam go to paradise? Or didn't he? How do you figure this out? Is Cain condemned or isn't? How do you figure that out? Are the saints and the higher orders of angels who are surrounding God also aware and possessors of all knowledge, or is only God the possessor of all knowledge? A whole series of these rather extraordinary questions, and the very idea of arguing about things, particularly about things theological, is a pretty daring idea in the 12th century. Up to now, you are simply given answers, but you don't ask questions. No rocking the boat, if you please. This rocks the boat and asks a whole series of rather difficult questions that have to be worked out. And the idea that people ought to be allowed to think for themselves, well, that's pretty radical, isn't it? The church thought it was bloody damn radical, I can tell you that. They got very cranky about it, and he got in trouble. Troubles had nothing to do with his logic. Troubles had to do with the fact that he was hired to tutor a very attractive young lady, the daughter of a city merchant. Her name was Eloise. And he tutored her very happily and for quite a long time, and they eventually had a relationship. And indeed, they seem, because he had only taken minor orders, they seem actually probably to have gotten secretly married. On the other hand, neither of them admitted to being married, but she didn't have a child. Well, her father was not charmed. Her brothers were not charmed. No one in the family was charmed by this.
and they took a fateful revenge on Abelard. They grabbed him and they seized him, they held him down, and they performed a small but hurried operation which guaranteed that he would never have another child again. As a result of that operation, Abelard is put out of commission for a while, and she establishes a nunnery. And there are a number of her letters that survive, letters that she continues to write to Abelard. She continues to love him. She respects his judgment. She asks him questions about how to deal with problems at the nunnery and so on. She idolizes him for as long as she lives. And indeed, after Abelard dies, his body is taken to that nunnery. She has already died and been buried there. He is buried beside her. They are, I suppose, it's a sweet story, so horrid way. They're about the most famous of the medieval lovers, in fact. Their tombs have now been moved to a famous cemetery in Paris, which has a rather horrid 19th century monument on top of it. By legend, lovers can go there, and if you can find a heart-shaped stone in the gravel, you'll have good luck, whatever that may mean. Their names continue to ring down the centuries in this way. But it is Abelard, indeed, who tends to bring this fresh wind into theology, to start, in fact, a whole series of new discussions, of new interests, and to enliven this entire study. And once that is begun, then you have a whole series of great medieval scholars to carry on. The most important of these is, I suppose, Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas is an Italian by birth, but he also goes up to the University of Paris, where he studies under a German scholar, Albert the Great. And it is Aquinas who, in the long run, manages to establish what position Aristotle will hold within the church. In other words, it takes until the 13th century before the church is finally able to digest Aristotle and find a place for him. Aquinas writes an enormous work called the Summa Theologiae, the summation of theological thought. It remains one of the key philosophic works in terms of theology of all time. Basically, what he establishes with Aristotle is this. The Bible is revealed truth. And as long as Aristotle is not in against anything said in the Bible itself, he is to be viewed as the authority on all things mundane and pertaining to this earth, such as biology and zoology and all the rest of these things. In other words, he's the authority on mundane things, the Bible is the authority on theological affairs, on morals, and so on. And if there is any conflict, it is always the Bible that is held. Now, what you have in the Middle Ages as a result of this is that Aristotle becomes a kind of theological authority as well. And you are in danger of being considered a heretic if you try to argue with anything that Aristotle says, as well as if you argue with anything the Bible says. So, in fact, it's fairly easy to be a heretic in this time. You've got to be very cautious. It does not pay to be a heretic. You get burned, literally. So what you have is a growing field of authority which is sanctioned by the church, and Aristotle eventually is brought within this kind of a system. There are, of course, all kinds of other scholars that go on, and the same kind of authority begins to be given to Roman law. It's notable that legal studies take on a kind of authority in this period. And that if the church will appeal to Thomas Aquinas, kings emperors and princes will appeal to Roman law against the church. So what you have growing here is a kind of secular authority in Roman law, to which various rulers can appeal for judgment against the church. So there is going to be a fairly consistent conflict of ideas going on in the Middle Ages. And all of this learning will take on forms. I don't suppose any of this is going to excite you, but it's so thoroughly medieval, I think I must explain it to you at least. You must understand that the church and ideas of the church invade every aspect of life in the Middle Ages. This is why it's called medieval synthesis, because everything is part of a whole. And one of the great problems that they discuss philosophically is the problem of what is real. What it is basically the old conflict between Plato and Aristotle. In the Middle Ages, it's called the conflict between realism and nominalism. And it runs along this basis. The realists say that the idea is the only reality. You must remember that realism means the exact opposite of what you think it means in the Middle Ages. Nominalism means that ideas, or general terms, are only names, and that reality exists in individual items and so on. In other words, if you take apples, does the existence of apples depend on there being an idea of what an apple is first? And you recognize apples, whether they are green or red or yellow or big or small or wormy, because of the reality of this concept that you recognize things from. And the realist would say that the concept is first. This is the basic reality. The nominalist would say, no, not at all. The basic reality is all this various variety of apples, and that you've already learned to recognize that no matter what the color or the shape or the size or the taste, they're all kind of like this, and they're not pears or grapes or any of these other things. And that you simply work out generic terms in this way from discrete individual things. Now, perhaps it doesn't matter an awful lot when you're talking about apples or tables or chairs or things like this. But when you get into the field of theology, this becomes a problem. Is the existence of the church dependent on worshipers? Or does it exist, even if there are no Christians left? Would the church still exist? And could, in fact, it be revived as soon as you have worship? It doesn't exist outside the discrete particles. Now, this is a very important factor. And this can get you, of course, into the field of heresy. It can get you in, get you burned again, in other words. And, in fact, the church tends to decide that realism is correct. That the concept or the idea is the basic reality, not the discrete parts. In other words, the church tends to be Platonic in concept and to gobble up Aristotle rather casually en route. So that these are going to be recurrent philosophical problems that run through. And much of the scholarship of the Middle Ages is built around disputes between realism and nominalism and things of this particular nature. It is notable also that the church has to expand in various ways with changing times. The general process within the church runs roughly this way, that you have, for instance, the foundation of monasteries. Remember, this goes clear way back to the 5th century. Now, monastic orders served a very real purpose. They were very useful in the countryside. They were helpful in agriculture. They were areas of protection. All of this kind of thing, because they're working organizations. But people tended to leave property to them and land to them in order that after their death, prayers would be said to help them out of purgatory. So monastic orders tend to get rich. And as they get rich, they get lazy. Let us put it this way. They grow what is called corrupt. Now, then along comes someone, usually a saint, who said, you've forgotten what you should be doing. You're no good. You're corrupt. I am going to reform this lousy way you have fallen into. And he goes off and starts a new reforming order. Now, because it is a reforming order and because it takes on new duties, what happens then is that people start leaving it money and the other people grow poorer and they start reforming themselves as well. In other words, the church reforms itself from within, time after time after time, in this same way. Corruption goes only so far, and then someone comes along to reform. St. Bernard of Clairvaux founds a Cistercian order because the Benedictines are, he thinks, too corrupt. They've become too worldly. They're too interested in music and painting and art and high living. Now, none of that's got anything to do with God at all. Back to God. Down on your knees, damn it, and do some work. And it works again and again here. And so the church goes through a consistent set of reforms. But of course, the monastic orders are connected with the countryside. In other words, they're not connected with the towns. And as the towns began to grow up, there was a real need now for people to take over and pay attention to the churchly needs of the towns. So two new orders are founded. These are the Dominicans and the Franciscans that are founded just around 1200, just after 13th century. And they are orders of preaching friars. And their main job, as they take over, is to take over the towns, the reform of the towns, to organize the towns, to preach to the people, to bring God to the inevitably faintly godless people who live in towns. Everyone knows that cities are corrupt. Even in the 12th and 13th century, cities are viewed as corrupt. Only farmers are pure. Never understood that. But still at all. So the Dominicans and Franciscans become preaching orders. They establish themselves in the various towns and cities, and they are rivals. Normally, in any European city, you will have on one side of town a great Dominican church, and at the other end of town, a great Franciscan church. They are both going to be big, they will be rich, they will be important, and they will also be enemies. Even within the church, rivalry is a consistent feature that goes on. And these are two basic rivals. Franciscans and Dominicans presumably are, of course, poor. What is owned by the order, not by the individuals. But it is notable that the Dominicans and Franciscans take over the universities. And these become the two great preaching and teaching orders of the Middle Ages. There is one other thing I ought to explain to you about universities and the way some get founded. Remember, I said they didn't have anything permanent. No libraries, no buildings, and so on. So, if they have a big enough quarrel with the town, if they think the town is gouging rents or throwing too many students in the jug, and so on, what they can do is to strike. And a university can, in fact, strike and simply get up and say, kind of gouge rents the hell with you, we'll move. All I've got is three books and a slate and two pieces of chalk. I'll walk away. We'll all walk away. You'll found the university somewhere else, and then where will you be? And they do. A whole series of new universities are founded this way. There's a famous strike at Oxford, which they had all kinds of riots and quarrels with the townspeople. The university, or a large part of it, simply got up and walked across England and settled down and founded Cambridge. And that is how Cambridge University was founded. That Oxford gets some of it back. But many universities are founded out of these kinds of structures. The earliest actual buildings that are permanent are dormitories. They are founded usually by men who leave money to found a dormitory with a chapel where persons from a certain part of the country can live. So that you will have in Paris, for instance, a building set up to house people from Normandy, or another one for students from Picardy, or another one for students from Britain. And these are the first permanent buildings. So that, for instance, the University of Paris, which is now called the Sorbonne, takes its name from the fact that the first permanent buildings were a dormitory put up by a man named Robert de Sorbonne. And that is the real beginning of Paris in terms of actual structure as such. Now, once you get enough of these dormitories put up, and then you begin to get lecture halls, then you can no longer structure. Then you have a full institution, and it's not as easy to find a new university. And that, of course, is what has happened.